June Elections Committee. And we have a long agenda today, particularly for the audience. So we will be moving as expeditiously as possible. I fully intend to give everyone, if possible, a chance to testify, but I also have a stopwatch up here which I intend to use. So when I say you are on the clock, I'm not kidding. The only one who is not is the author. And with that, we do not have a quorum, but Representative Simon, I believe you do have a delete everything amendment.
I do.
So why don't you talk to the amendment, and when we have a quorum, we will move the amendment and then put your bill in the order that you desire. Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just by way of introduction, first of all, I want to thank you, Mr. Chair. I know it's a short session and a busy session, and I appreciate personally you giving the opportunity for this issue to be heard and for me to be heard. I'm very grateful.
Representative Simon, just as a point of order, too, I believe we have... We have 12 constitutional amendments among the 310 bills that this committee has before it. So this is constitutional amendment number one.
Okay.
Representative
Hopefully
Simon.
First among equals. Thank you.
Representative Simon, yes. I'll emphasize equal.
Okay.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, it's very tempting, members, to think about this as a lawyer issue, because let's face it, none of us who are elected are going to win or lose a single vote, probably, on the basis of how we vote on this bill. We're just not. And most of our constituents probably don't really care about this issue to the extent that they follow it at all, and I realize that. But in my opinion, this is not a lawyer issue. This is an everybody issue, because in every courthouse, every day, in every county in Minnesota, there are decisions being made that affect all of us, whether we're litigants, witnesses, bystanders, or just citizens. And I think that's an important circumstance to realize. The reason we're really here isn't because this is an academic exercise and a bunch of people thought, wouldn't it be neat to change the Constitution, or that this is just some sort of project. We're here because of a court case called the White case. And the White case changed our lives in this area in three important ways. There are three things that judges or judicial candidates could do before the White case, or couldn't do before the White case, that they can do now. Three things. So the White case changed these three things. First, judges and judicial candidates now, not before White, but now, can directly raise money for their campaigns. Before they couldn't. In fact, they couldn't even attend their own fundraising events. Secondly, judges and judicial candidates can now solicit and accept political endorsements of all kinds. They couldn't do that before. Now they can. And third, and most damaging in my opinion, and the opinion of many others, judges after White can now announce their positions on disputed legal issues that are likely to come before them. Now just think about that for a minute. What that means is that judges can do like all of us who are elected here do, and that is they can campaign based on outcomes, promised or pledged outcomes. And that's a really big deal, because all of us in this room who are elected, we gladly and happily campaign on outcomes. Vote for Pawlowski, you'll get more of this, less of that. Vote for Hilty, you'll get more of this, less of that. Vote for Anderson, etc., etc. But judges are different, because judges are not catchers or pitchers or batters. Judges are umpires. And we would never think of putting an umpire in a Major League Baseball game who said to Major League Baseball, put me in the game and I'll make sure the Yankees win. Or put me in the game and I'll make sure the Red Sox win. We would never, ever tolerate that. But that's exactly the post-White world that we live in. With judges and judicial candidates saying, vote for me, I'm the pro-life judge, I'm the pro-choice judge, I'm the pro-mom's getting custody judge, I'm the pro-dad's getting custody judge, I'm the lock-em-up judge, I'm the leniency judge, whatever it is. And that is really, really dangerous. Campaigning like we do freely and openly and proudly on outcomes, that's a bad, bad thing. And that's precisely what the post-White world is ushering in. And make no mistake, we're not unique, we're not exceptional. Although we like to say that all our kids are above average and that Minnesota is unique in a lot of ways, the storm is coming. There's no question about it. Whether it's Wisconsin or Ohio or Texas or Alabama, all the states where this kind of atmosphere has been allowed to flourish have resulted in highly charged, highly politicized, highly ideological judicial campaigns where outcomes are what the election are about. Not fitness, not whether you're a good or bad judge or jurist, but outcomes. Promise and pledge outcomes. And that's a bad thing. So if we do nothing, if we're sure that the system that has worked for the past few decades is sure to work for the next several decades, we're in big trouble. If we wait for the storm, then we're just putting our heads in the sand because the storm is coming. So white changes everything.
That's insane.
And
excuse me for 1 second. We're going to, we now have a quorum. I'm going to move that House File 3023 be recommended to pass. No, we can't until we have the bill before us. Be recommended to pass and be sent to the Public Safety and Civil Justice Committee. The bill is now before, so Representative Simon, why don't you move your delete everything amendment, and then we will work off the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move the DE1 amendment.
Representative Simon moves the DE1 amendment. Is there any discussion? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Representative Simon, members, we are working off the DE1 amendment now instead of the bill. Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good timing because I'd like to now describe the bill as amended.
All right, Representative Simon.
As I said, Mr. Chair, white changes everything, particularly that third and most harmful byproduct, which is that judges and judicial candidates can now freely talk about outcomes, and they will, if permitted, particularly when political parties are involved and ideologically based interest groups on either side or any side. They will do that as they have in other states, and that's harmful to all of us. And so here's what the bill does. And I might add that the bill has some tremendous support. The Minnesota State Bar Association is by and large behind this. We had some quibbling and probably still have a couple things that we have to work out in terms of appointing authorities and so forth. But in sum and substance, the State Bar Association is behind this bill now, which is a major development. There had been, before last week, three camps. There was the Quay Commission reform camp, the Bar Association reform camp, and then the status quo camp. Now there are only two camps because the Bar Association, Mr. Melendez, is working out some final details, but I think in sum and substance we're united on this. Former Governor Carlson, former Vice President Mondale, Alan Page of the Supreme Court, Chief Justice Russell Anderson, and a whole host of other groups. So here's what the bill does. Primarily three things, and this is reflected in the DE1 amendment. First, it would extend merit selection, which we already have for district court judges, it would extend merit selection to all levels of the Minnesota judiciary, that is, the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court. So the governor would be required to select from a list of three people submitted by the selection commission. And incidentally, I should point out that the selection commission would be appointed, and this is the first time ever in Minnesota history, would be appointed by the Supreme Court, by the governor, and by the legislature. So for the first time, the legislature would have a direct hand, or at least an indirect hand, in appointing judges. And I think that's a very important part of the bill. The second thing that this bill does, and this reform effort does, is it creates a performance evaluation commission to independently evaluate a judge's performance during the judge's term. And this is something that even some of the opponents who I know are here today, like Mr. Carruthers, at least in our prior discussions, supports. This portion, if he doesn't support it at all, and some of the opponents, they at least say this is a good thing. Because judges, like any of us, and anyone in any job, need accountability. Citizens need information. And the results of this performance review would be released. It would not be on the ballot. That was an initial proposal of the Quay Commission, but that's no longer part of the bill. There would be no notation or reference of any kind to what any one group, this or newspaper editorial board or any other influential group said. But this would allow citizens yet another piece of information. Because let's face it, how many times, members, have people asked you before an election, who should I vote for judge? You're in office. You must know these people. People have very, very little information. And this would just at least be one way, no different than any other interest group or newspaper editorial board or anyone else of influence to provide some information.
Why don't you just walk us through the DE1 amendment,
sure,
and then we know what you have changed and specifically what you're making reference to.
Sure.
I think that would probably expedite things.
Okay. So, well, if I may, Mr. Chair, just one other point, and then I'll talk about the changes, because I think the concept is as important or more important than the actual changes. And the last point I wanted to make, Mr. Chair, is that this, and this is a big change that you hear about or read about, this would move us to a retention election system. Right now, it's candidate versus candidate. But this would move Minnesota to a system that many other states have enjoyed, which is a retention election. So it would be yes or no on Judge Pawlowski. On an election, it wouldn't be Judge Pawlowski versus some challenger, or Judge Pawlowski versus nobody, which is the case, 90-some percent of the time. And I just want to say one thing about that, Mr. Chair, before I move into the details of the DE1 amendment. You know, you're going to hear today, members, specifically from some members of the District Judges Association, although you'll find out today that they're very, very divided. The majority of their membership wants change, but they're deadlocked about what kind of change, and so their official position is we don't need to do anything, status quo, system's fine, no problem. And what you'll hear is this phrase. They'll say, well, you know, a retention election is like running against the perfect nobody. You know, we can all imagine what life would be like without Judge Pawlowski, let's say, and we might have these fantasies of who it might be, but there's not a flesh and blood person. And while that's an alluring argument, and I suppose true in some sense, you got to think this way. In a retention election system, at least as practiced and enjoyed in other states, it really makes far, far less likely the possibility or the probability that highly charged ideological groups or partisan groups will take part. Why? Because you don't know what you're going to get. You don't know what you're going to get if you defeat Judge Pawlowski or any judge, and you're kind of rolling the dice. And that makes it a lot less likely that partisan political activity will obtain. And one other point, Mr. Chair, you know, under the current system, I mentioned it a moment ago how all of us are probably asked how you're going to vote for judge. Under the current system, in some ways, we really have fake elections, when you think about it. There's an incumbent designation, which already kind of cooks the books in favor of the sitting judge, number one. None of us enjoy that mark by our name. And then secondly, let's face it, you turn over the back of that ballot and very, very few judges have any sort of competition. With a retention election, every single time that the judge is up, every single time, there's the possibility that that judge could lose their job. Now, in other states, that happens very, very rarely, but it's at least a possibility, whereas here, as of the mid-July filing date that we have in Minnesota, 90-some% of judges are home free. They're completely clear, and there is no competition. So it's more or less a Soviet-style election on the back page of that ballot, where you've got a bunch of judges with nothing but write-in underneath their name. And I think that's got to change as well. So to the DE1 amendment, Mr. Chair, nothing is changed as to the constitutional amendment and that language in Article 1 on page 1. Article 2 on page 2, the only major changes here as to the bill as introduced is the makeup, or I should say the composition of who gets to appoint, who the authorities appoint. For example, remember we're creating two commissions here. One is the selection commission and one is the evaluation commission. The CUI commission majority report, which the bill as introduced was faithful to, the CUI commission majority report had only the governor and the chief justice as the appointing authority. Well, I listened to what a lot of legislators and others said, including Mr. Carruthers, when we met, and I think he made the very forceful point that, you know, it ought not to be just the governor and the chief justice. You know, we in the legislature have a say, too. We represent constituents, and it's important that the legislature have a say as well. So we more or less divided it evenly amongst the legislative branch and all three branches. So that's a change. Similarly, with the Evaluation Commission, it's almost even there as well, Mr. Chair, where we have now, and this was not in the original bill, we have the three appointing authorities, not just the two. I would say that there are a number of technical changes that Mr. Gehring could probably illuminate more than I could that have to do with commissions. I'm not an expert on formation of commissions, but there were a number of changes that we had to make, very technical in nature, that have to do with...
Just a question. I noticed on the original bill, it was introduced on February 18th. Can you tell me the date that the CUI Commission finished its work and we had the report done?
You know, I don't know the exact date, and maybe Governor Cui, when he speaks, since he lived it for 14 months.
All right. I would prefer that we not have testimony from the audience. We would be, Governor Cui will have his chance, so that's fine. We'll just proceed. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you. And so the primary changes are basically to the appointing authorities. And then the other thing, as I mentioned before, was getting rid of what the CUI Commission originally had, which was designating, beside the name of the judge who's up for retention, designating either qualified or unqualified based on what the Evaluation Commission said. We decided not to do that. It didn't seem fair to us, us meaning legislators. After all, nobody else that we can think of on the ballot runs with some sort of subjective descriptor by their name. You wouldn't say Steve Simon, (total fool) or something like that. No one's going to vote for that person. So we didn't think it very fair to put something subjective like that. That's another thing that I picked up from, and I think, you know, rightly so, from some of the skeptics. I think I made a good point on that. So we decided to get rid of that as well. Those are the sum and substance of the changes, Mr. Chair. The rest are highly technical, having to do with commissions that I don't personally.
All right, Mr. Gehring,
know about.
You want to walk us through some of the technical changes of the bill, and if you do it page by page, so we would be able to see what they are.
Mr. Chair, like Representative Simon said, there are a number of sort of technical language fixes that come from the DE1 amendment from House File 3023. On page one, the language of that is to be included in the Constitution was changed to reflect the fact that, as Representative Simon mentioned, the subjective evaluation of judges would not appear on the ballot, so that language has been removed. On page two, the wording of the question to be posed to the voters when they are voting on whether they want to approve the constitutional amendment or not has been modified slightly to attempt to reflect more accurately the procedure that's being set up in the bill. On page four, in section 8 of the bill, there's additional language specifying that in the event that a selection commission does not submit a list of nominees to the governor within the required time frame, that the governor may appoint any qualified individual to fill the vacancy, regardless of whatever the commission eventually comes up with. Section 9 on page 5. There are a number of smaller pieces in here. First is a specification in subdivision 1, basically mirroring some of the provisions that apply to the current Judicial Selection Commission. That's section 480B.01, subdivisions 7, 9, 10, and 12 is included. Those specific cross references are not included in the original bill. And these are sections that basically govern the way the commissions would conduct business. So posting of meetings and making them public, they're required to submit a report to the governor annually that provides demographic data on applicants for judicial vacancies. It also provides procedures for commissions to recruit candidates for judicial office. In paragraph B of subdivision 1, section 8 of the bill, eliminated is the requirement that, in the original bill, there's a requirement that there be an attorney balance, or basically a balance in favor of non-attorneys. That language has been removed. The big changes, as Representative Simon mentioned, in subdivision 2 of section 8 is the method in which commission members are to be appointed. And here, in the delete all amendment, as Representative Simon mentioned, there's a legislative appointment process that exists. The first version of the bill had just gubernatorial appointments from the Chief Justice. On page 6 of the delete all amendment, subdivision 3, there's similar new language that I referenced earlier about the governor being able to appoint anyone if the commission doesn't complete its work on time. In section 10 of the bill, the Judicial Performance Commission, I believe the number of the commission number is modified slightly. This new language regarding the qualifications to be a member of the commission, and new language related to the way commission members are to be appointed, including the appointment by the legislature. In subdivision 3 of the delete all amendment on page 7, 7.35 and 7.36, open meetings law is now applies entirely to the Judicial Performance Commission. Under the first version of the bill, the open meetings law would apply, but there are a number of exceptions for when the commission could close a meeting. In this case, the language says that the open meetings law applies entirely. There's also a provision in the section that is new that says that data collected by the commission is public data according to the Data Practices Act. Between lines 8.16 and 8.32, there's new language that allows the Supreme Court to adopt a rule governing survey procedures, and it specifies a little bit more clearly the types of surveys that the Performance Commission must send out and who must receive them in order to evaluate the performance of a judge. Subdivision 6 at the bottom of page 8 is a new provision that specifies explicitly that the commission is to evaluate a judge halfway through the judge's term. On the top of page 9, there's new language specifying that the performance commission is to evaluate a judge at the end of the judge's term or near the end of the judge's term. Subdivision 8 is a brand new subdivision which specifies that evaluations may be conducted by a panel of 5 members of the commission, so it's not the entire 25-member commission doing an evaluation of every judge. It would be a panel of 5. And Representative Simon can maybe speak about this more directly. Basically, these panels would meet individually to conduct evaluations of judges and would vote on whether the judge is qualified or unqualified. And there's provisions in this new language specifying that review by the full commission if a panel decides that a judge is unqualified or if one panelist or 3 members of the commission request a review. The new subdivision 9, line 9.19, specifies publication of the results of the final evaluation. This basic language does exist in the first version of the bill, but this is just specified a little bit more clearly that the results have to be published 1 month before a judge would file an affidavit of candidacy for retention. Subdivision 10 on page 9, line 9.24, specifies that the commission may adopt additional rules for evaluating judges and to ensure that and performance of the commission's duties. Section 12 of the bill at the bottom of page 9 establishes certain requirements for service on any of the commissions that are adopted or that are established under Chapter 480B. That would include the existing Judicial Selection Commission, the newly proposed Appellate Court Selection Commission, and the Judicial Performance Commission. Prohibited is service on multiple commissions by any one person at the same time. And it also specifies at the top of page 10 that a person who is appointed to a commission serves on the commission for their 4-year or 2-year term, depending on who appoints you, but that you also serve until a successor has been appointed and qualified. And that language is meant to sort of fill the gap between the end of a term and the later appointment. Section 13 of the bill specifies that meetings can be conducted by telephone or electronically, provided that at least one person is present at the normal meeting location. This language basically is crafted off of existing language in other statutes that allows commissions to conduct meetings this way, and is partially designed to not require that a full group of 25 or 30 people has to meet at the same time and have to secure a quorum to deal with those issues. Section 14 of the bill specifies the first meeting of the Judicial Performance Commission. The first meeting is to be held at least or within 30 days of all commission members being appointed. And, Mr. Chair, I believe that is all that is new. I'm going to delete everything.
President Simon, you have anything to add to the... No.
No, Mr. Chair.
Do you want to proceed to the testifier?
Thanks. If I may, just a couple closing remarks just about the bill as a whole.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So basically, just to recap, members, the White decision, the post-White world means we already do have, judges and judicial candidates talking about outcomes, the umpires talking about an outcome. And the best way that I've seen, surely flawed, surely has some warts, but the best way that I've seen to diminish the possibility, can't eliminate it, no way can you eliminate it, best way to diminish it is through a retention election system, which has been very successful, well-liked, and in fact embraced by judges who initially opposed it in other states, like Missouri and Iowa and Arizona and others, where, by the way, the costs of running for judicial office are way, way down. There isn't nearly the level of partisan or ideological fury or fighting, and you don't have the big sort of special interest-driven elections. And most importantly, you don't have the talk on the judicial level about outcomes. So we have to ask ourselves, Mr. Chair and members, you know, who really stands to benefit if we do nothing? Who makes out well if we just say status quo, there isn't a problem, may happen in other states, it's never going to happen in our state? Who stands to benefit? Well, currently, I might say respectfully and maybe recklessly, since I'm before many district court judges, but the organized district court judges probably benefit, because on an individual judge-by-judge basis, it probably is better for the individual judge to keep the better system. After all, they've only got a 1 in 20 shot of ever having an opponent, and there's no organized mechanism for feedback right now. In fact, in Hennepin County, when that was attempted a few years ago, the judges rose up and in anger, basically, at the idea that someone would actually evaluate the performance and that would be made public. So that's who would stand to gain. And I mean no disrespect to judges. What they do is hard work, and it takes a really smart, hardworking person to be a good judge. But I think, like anyone, judges should be accountable. And you'll hear from some judges today who think that though they may not personally come out well under a change, they agree that Minnesota will come out well for change, and I appreciate their bravery in coming forward. So do we really want to go down the same road as Texas and Alabama and even neighboring Wisconsin, where just last year they had a knockdown, drag-out race for Supreme Court justice, where people were promising outcomes on both sides, and labor and business and all sorts of interests were bankrolling candidates to the tune of millions? Do we want to do that, or do we want to slow or impede that kind of thing in Minnesota? And let me just admit right now, you know, we shouldn't be looking for the perfect solution here. Absolutely, there's no way retention elections can stop of judicial races. It's absolutely true. A sitting judge could be the victim of a so-called drive-by shooting. You could have a special interest group come in October and launch a surprise vote no on Judge Pawlowski campaign. Could it happen? Absolutely it could. And I have no doubt that judges, the first election cycle, will be very scared and be wanting to raise a lot of money and be in a defensive posture. That's absolutely true. We can't get rid of it. But can we diminish it? Yes, we can, and that's been the experience in other states. We absolutely can diminish it. We can't stop it. But I'm here to say today that I don't want to live in a post-white world where we have judicial candidates talking about outcomes. They're not players on the field, they're umpires. And we ought to have a system in Minnesota that safeguards a truly independent and nonpartisan judiciary. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you, Representative Simon. The first testifier is former Governor El Cui.
Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Al Cui, and I was the chair of the Citizens Commission for the Preservation of an Impartial Judiciary, and I am now the chair of the board of Minnesotans for Impartial Courts, which, if legislation providing for a constitutional amendment passes, we will be pushing to help it be adopted by the people of the state. That's my position.
Governor Cui, who formed that commission?
The commission? It was formed this way. Justice Barry Anderson and I had breakfast, and he asked if I would chair it. And then a number of people came together, and you'll hear from two of them as well. And then selected individuals who had been thinking of this, and so there were 30 individuals on that. And so what we tried to do is take people who are normally at odds with each other, you know, the head of the trial lawyers, head of the defense lawyers, Brian Melendez of the AFL-CIO, and Annette Meeks of the Republican, an example, and Dan Michaels, organized labor, Helen Palmer, try and find that cross section.
And we
raised no money, spent no money. We met for 14 months.
But Governor Cui, this was not formed at the direction of the legislature or the judicial branch or the executive branch.
No, it was not. It was not. However, you have to say that Chief Associate Justice Barry Anderson was involved in the forming of it.
All right. Governor Cui, when did the commission finish its work?
In March of 2007, end of March 2007.
And when the commission finished its work, did it have a draft piece of legislation at that time ready for introduction?
No, we gave our recommendations, which is in the report, and then the draft piece of legislation which you have before us was put together by Representative Simon with the help of people here in the legislature, correct?
Correct. All right. Thank you. Proceed, Governor Quick.
Mr. Chairman, could I ask you if it would be possible in my time for another person to say something who's on our board?
Yes. Perfectly acceptable.
It's very acceptable. Yeah.
Jason Stoley, is that?
Yes, Jason Stoll.
Jason Stoll.
Yeah, so,
if you would like to come down.
Yeah, so if you could come
sure.
And pick up this. Mr. Chair.
Governor Quigg.
We all have a position, but there are some individuals who don't have power. So on our board, we ask Jason Stoll to come on there. He has had... he grew up in the streets. He was in a gang and got his power. He's been before judges. He served time. And I just wanted to, I wanted that kind of influence to be on our board. So let me go ahead with this.
Now, Governor Quigg, just before you begin again, Mr. Soule, would you just identify yourself for the record, please? So
my name is Jason Soule.
All right. Thank you. Governor Quigg.
Okay. Now, Minnesota on occasion, both with the legislature and the changing of the Constitution, has worked to ensure the impartiality of our courts. The example of the legislature is when you enacted the Judicial Selection Commission to make nominations for the trial court judges. The courts themselves worked on this, so in 1995, Canon 5 of the Code of Judicial Conduct then prohibited that candidates for judgeship be able to announce their views on legal or political issues. And then they further added prohibitions on the political activities of judicial candidates. And then in 2008 to 2006, litigation went through the federal courts, and the Supreme Court and Eighth Circuit then declared that these Canon 5 provisions are unconstitutional. In the light of what happened there, Minnesotans cannot carry on as though nothing happened. Canon 5 is dead, and its memory won't protect the impartiality of our judges. The issue isn't the partisan states. They've always been engaged in this kind of activity. And I want to mention partisan states, including Missouri, because out of the 114 counties in Missouri, only four have retention elections. The other 110 have partisan elections. And so we've been a nonpartisan state since 1913. Now, another nonpartisan state, just to the east of us, Wisconsin, has just been hit in 2007 with an acrimonious and is estimated $6 billion campaign for a seat on the Supreme Court. Already there's a scandal because the person who was elected did not recuse herself when the court had a case where her biggest contributor was a part of that case. And so you can look in contrast then to the state of Iowa. And the state of Iowa, which had the retention election for years, in the last three election cycles, 2002, 2004, 2006, not one cent was raised or spent in the judicial elections. Now, these 30 citizens of who came together and worked for those 14 months had basically three recommendations with results in the fourth. And the first one is that the electorate ought to know something about the performance of the judge who's seeking to continue in office. And performance evaluations are not new. It's used all over our society for the benefit of employees and those who decide retention, and is used by other states for their judges. We unanimously agreed that an appointed performance evaluation commission should be established, and it should be made up of individuals who have outstanding competence and reputation and be broadly representative of the diversity of the state. And they should evaluate performance of all sitting judges and provide that information to the electorate. And we speak of, when you talk about what they will be evaluated on, it would be knowledge and respect of the law, the Constitution, and precedent, integrity, respect for litigants, punctuality, administrative skills, and communication skills. The commission shall not evaluate the decisions of the judges. We have an appeals process for that. Now, secondly, here we struggle with the question of who should decide whether the judge should continue or not. And the majority came to the conclusion that we should not take the vote away from the people. The electorate have always had the right in our state to vote on judges. We also realize that the performance evaluation commission cannot work in contested elections. So what we recommended is then that we use the retention elections that have been observed and studied in a number of other states and that they've used for decades. Now the third one was, as Representative Simon indicated, that we recommend a merit selection commission for the appellate courts as well. You have the experience with the trial courts. And nominations have been used by people to select the best possible person in all kinds of organizations in our life. It's well used and well accepted. And so that's where we come down. And then the fourth one just follows that with the above, all the new judges would be appointed by the governor, not the 90% where it occurs right now. And also, the result of that will be few judges would leave before the end of their term anymore. Well, nothing is, you know, is perfect. And first, the result would be seldom would campaign contributions be raised or partisan conflict occur when each judge seeks to continue in office. But free speech is not stifled, and these things can happen and have happened in a few cases. Last year, in Wisconsin, just bear in mind that, in the country, $33 million was spent in contested elections, but in retention elections, $1,000.
Governor Cleland, I want to interrupt you just for a second. I'm looking at the packet of information that we all received.
You got all that.
I got it at home and I got it here. I'm just curious to the statement that you made that there was no money raised for this. Who paid for this? How was this paid for? I see these citizens, Minnesota for an impartial court, but who are they and where did the money come to?
No money was raised for the Citizens Commission for the Preservation of Impartial Courts. However, or impartial judiciary. However, the Minnesotans for Impartial Courts is a 501c4 organization, and we are raising money from law firms, from corporations, from individuals. We have employed Kimberly Horner, who successfully helped get the Transportation Amendment through. We have a board of individuals who are watching this very close. We have people on our board who have worked with political campaigns, the successful political campaigns on both, and specifically on the DFL side. And so these are the ones, and we're raising money and have raised enough funds to keep us going.
And Governor Quay, how much would that have been, do you know?
How much would that be?
How much money was raised here?
And so far, I'd have to ask somebody from outside right here, and I don't have that with me right now. But I would expect that it probably would, I'll try to be, it would be something like $200,000 at least that has been raised so far, not counting the pledges.
All right.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you.
The other three things I want to say about the result is that the public confidence in the judges would really be increased if we did this, especially the people without power. And the judges' performances will improve because anybody who's evaluated knows that they'll be evaluated, they do better later on. We learned that as kids. We acted better when our parents were watching. And fourth, there will be a better understanding by the citizens of our judicial system. So the task is ahead of you, and the reason for the amendment that Representative Simon's talking about is that there's great suspicion over the Performance Evaluation Commission. And therefore, you people will deal with that and try and develop the a commission where the people who are selected, who select the commission members, will be individuals who pick the most high quality individuals as possible. Now, our greatest problem isn't what you'll do, it's what if you might not do something. Let me just share a story with you. When I was governor, the Department of Transportation showed me a study that in 25 to 35 years, we would have a serious problem with our bridges and our highways. And as a governor, I recommended a 10-cent increase in the gas tax and also indexing it so it keeps its purchasing power. When that bridge came down, I was having my horse shot, and the woman in the house where the horses are there came out to tell me about it. The first thing I thought about was the horror of the people who went down with that bridge. The second was, were either of my two sons who traveled that bridge on the bridge? And the third one was, after I left office, I never did anything about it. I believe in the partiality of our judicial system. We are in danger. And I urge you to do the best you can that we might have an impartial judiciary in Minnesota. Now, could I just ask Jason Soule if you
Mr. Soule,
say a few words?
Mr. Soule, I would just like to give a brief testimony. In 2005, I made a terrible decision that will actually haunt me for the rest of my life. My criminal behavior placed me before a judge where I fought for a downward departure because I was facing 110 months in prison for a drug crime. Over 200 people came to court to testify on my behalf, to speak about my value in the community and how the community could benefit from my criminal activity. Well, in a nutshell, the judge decided to not send me to prison. We stand a chance of losing valuable judges by having partisan elections because we tend to forget the unfortunate. In my field of corrections, public safety is based on accountability of the offenders, but I believe judges need to be held accountable as well. Retention elections will actually give power to the people who have no power. And I just want to say, I believe impartial courts are needed in order to uplift humanity. Thank you.
Thank you, Governor. Mr. Soule, thank you very much. Next on the agenda, I have Phil Carruthers. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members. I am Phil Carruthers. I'm an assistant Ramsey County attorney. I'm the head of the prosecution division of the Ramsey County Attorney's Office. I am here to testify on this bill, and I do want to thank Representative Simon because he did sit down with me, and I did bring some issues to his attention, and I think he has started to address a number of those issues. And so I do thank him for that. I think he has improved his bill. However, I have to tell you that I don't think this is a bill that the legislature should pass. I don't mind being somebody who's portrayed as being a defender of the status quo. I don't mind being a person portrayed as being a conservative, because we're talking about our Constitution, and we're talking about protecting the rights of our citizens to vote. And if that's protecting the status quo, I'm all for it. You know, judicial reform is kind of like education reform. You know, often it doesn't accomplish much, and in some cases, it makes matters worse. That is what I am concerned about here, that this will not improve things, but in fact, will make matters worse. Whenever you hear the word reform, you'll always have to ask, whose reform and who does it benefit? There's no question that after White, we have to be concerned about attack ads, expensive campaigns, committing to outcomes, political party endorsements, special interest involvement. But first of all, changing the Constitution should be the last resort, not the first resort. if we change the Constitution without knowing exactly what we are doing, we will be stuck with the effects of that for 150 years. That's how old our current Constitution is, including the right to vote for judges. 150 years old. And I would hate to see us make mistakes that will be with us for that long. You know, I think there are a lot of things that can be done to address the issues raised by the White case. And I have an article that I did for a legal seminar, Constitutional Amendments on Judicial Elections, Premature, Unwise, with Unintended Consequences. And at the back of that, possible alternatives to the Quay Commission proposal. Performance evaluation is a good idea, but government should not be in the role of telling voters who to vote for. I think you can have a performance where you list how people do, how judges do in various categories, but to have government say, this is who you should vote for, that is completely inappropriate. You know, in dictatorships, what they do is the government tells people how to vote, and then to make sure on every race there's only one candidate. And that's essentially what this proposal would do. Tell the people how to vote, and then you only get one candidate to vote for. So performance evaluation is appropriate, but let's not take it to the extreme of telling the voters how to vote. Merit selection is a good idea. There are problems with the current law because it's totally dominated by the governor, and the governors, the members serve at the pleasure of the governor. I think that should be changed. Recusal rules. If somebody makes a promise, a specific promise, and commits how they're going to vote on a case, then they should have to recuse themselves because that's not what a judge does. A judge has to listen to the arguments, read the arguments, written arguments, and then make a decision. If a judge knows who contributes, you can have a recusal rule as well. Contribution limits. Minnesota is one of the few states in the country that does not have contribution limits on judicial campaigns. Somebody could give $1 million the last week of a campaign. That would be perfectly legal. Inappropriate, in my view. So there are other things that can be done. Now, the whole flaw with the argument that we have to go to retention elections is the following. The rights laid out in White are constitutional rights under the United States Constitution, and they apply across the board. They don't just apply to contested elections. They apply to every kind of election. They apply, in fact, to any kind of selection or retention system. That's why they're constitutional rights. So it's just wishful thinking to think that all you have to do is change the type of election and all the problems go away. Now, you know, of course I, like you, have served in the legislature. I've been through campaigns. Now, you know, we hear complaints from the public about how nasty sometimes legislative campaigns can be, how partisan they are. Okay, well, let's just change legislative campaigns to retention campaigns. Do any of us think that those elections wouldn't still be partisan? That they wouldn't be harsh and negative? That is the nature of politics, and judges have tremendous power. Think of cases that they have come down with. Gore, Bush versus Gore, Roe versus Wade, Miranda, Escobedo, all sorts of cases. Judges have power, so of course people are going to apply politics to a retention election. So it's just, I'm sorry, it's unrealistic to think that all you have to do is change the type of election and all the problems go away. And in fact, when you look at states that have retention election systems, they've had nasty, expensive, partisan races. In my materials here, I list a bunch of them. Nebraska, Tennessee, Missouri, Pennsylvania, Wyoming, California. They've all had those. The other thing that I have to emphasize is there is no consensus on this issue whatsoever. The Quay Commission couldn't agree. The key vote on retention versus appointment was 14 to 11. There's a majority report and two minority reports. The Bar Association, when they came for a resolution to the Legislative Assembly to support the Quay Commission report. It passed by one vote. One vote. The Quay Commission recommendations are opposed by Minnesota County Attorneys Association, Minnesota District Judges Association, AFSCME, Council 5, which represents a lot of the people who work in the court system, public defenders, prosecutors, court staff. Minneapolis Central Labor Union Council opposes this. You know, if we're going to work on and pass a constitutional amendment, shouldn't it be something that has broad support? You know, how is this going to pass the voters if the State Bar Association, it passed by one vote? Unlikely, in my opinion. Minnesota, the other Carruthers, I believe we, Representative Winkler has a question.
Okay.
Mr. Carruthers, I guess I don't understand the basis for the county attorney's opposition to the bill. I've heard from the district court judges, but frankly, the strength of your, or the vehemence of your argument regarding the merits to the public overall of this proposal, against this proposal, and you're appealing to fairly broad notions of good government, et cetera, but that seems to be somewhat undermined by the vehemence of your argument. And I'm wondering what the interest of the county attorneys is in opposing the bill.
Speaks Carruthers. Well, yeah, I tend to get a little vehement, you know, sometimes, and especially when we're talking about the right to vote. You know, that's a big deal. And when we're talking about changing the fundamental structure of our government, that's a big deal. That is a big deal. And it doesn't just change the judiciary. It affects the whole checks and balances that affect the legislature as well. So, and in terms of the County Attorneys Association, I was only there for one meeting, but the elected county attorneys spoke very strongly about protecting the voters' franchise, the right of voters to vote. And they're elected officials themselves. They felt very strongly about that. And, you know, there are other people here, Sandy Nairn, who was probably at more of these meetings than I am.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Carruthers, I guess it's, I certainly wouldn't suggest that you're not concerned about the right to vote, but we deal with a lot of voting issues in this committee, and this is the first time we've seen this kind of testimony before. So I'm suggesting that there is probably a larger interest that you're not talking about other than the interest in voting, and I don't know what it is. I'm trying to understand what the basis for the opposition is amongst the county attorneys, because I haven't seen any county attorneys here talking about voting rights before.
Speaker Carruthers. Well, Mr. Chairman, maybe Mr. Representative Winkler, when you say that there must be some other reason that I have that, you know, why don't you explain to me what that other reason that I have for opposing changes to our Constitution? You know, maybe if you've got something, Mr. Winkler, why don't you say it?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Carruthers, I don't know what that might be. I just see secret discussions, given new power, weakened judicial independence, new powers to the governor. I mean, it just sounds like a very strong argument, and I'm trying to understand what the motivation for making a strong argument against it. I don't know what it is, but I'm trying to understand what the real issues for debate are, and we could have a lengthy discussion about the merits of this proposal, and I think we should, but this seems more like a critique of this specific plan as opposed to a general discussion of this, and so I'm just wondering if there is some other basis other than you're criticizing it on the merits.
Well, Representative Winkler, one observation I would have, and I've been here, I was elected actually with Speaker Carruthers in the same year. His first statement, judicial reform is like educational reform. For those of us in education who have suffered outcome-based education, the grad rule and the profile of learning, and now the most onerous burden of all, No Child Left Behind, when we start to banter around reform, and it's reform from another state, and there's No Child Left Behind from a failed school district in another state, the consequences are quite severe, and the price tag is extremely high. I'm not going to question Representative Carruthers' motives for being here, but certainly if we're bantering around reform and reform of something that's going on in another state that has not occurred in the state, and we're changing the Constitution to do it, I'd like to be a little cautious myself.
Caution is warranted, Mr. Chair.
Representative Winkler, I've heard your statement. Mr. Carruthers.
Okay, well, let me just address that. You know, why do I make statements like secret meetings? Okay, the bill was changed to provide that it comes under the open meeting law, but there's a specific exception under the open meeting law for evaluations, performance evaluations. You can hold those in closed sessions. That's what the Performance Evaluation Commission exists for. So virtually all of their meetings could be secret. That's my concern there. As far as the membership, the Performance Evaluation Commission, 25 members, 9 are appointed by the governor, 8 are appointed by the Chief Justice. In the course of a governor's term, most governors appoint a Chief Justice. Okay? So we have 17 of 25 members who are either appointed by the governor or a potential ally of the governor. Then you've got 2 members each from the minority and majority. But, you know, if you've got a two-party system, half of those are going to be of the same party as the governor, okay? So you set up a scenario where virtually all of the appointments to the Performance Evaluation Commission could easily be from people of one party. Now, I think that is dangerous because, you know, if you want to control the judiciary, if you want to get rid of some judges because you disagree with them or they're of a different party, what would be the best way to do it? You have a so-called independent commission who announces that these people are unqualified. You know, that's a very powerful tool that can be used potentially, and I certainly don't think this of our current governor or our current Chief Justice. They're outstanding people. They've done a good job of judicial appointments. But in the future, we don't know who the governor is going to be, you know? And this isn't, you know, not every governor is going to be committed to impartiality or independence. There are going to be governors who have a strong political agenda and will work hard to achieve it. I think it's dangerous to have a performance evaluation commission that can be loaded so easily in favor of one party. And then the other, a structural concern I have is the Chief Justice will appoint a lot of the people on both the merit selection panel and in the performance evaluation panel. That gives the Chief Justice a surprising amount of power over the people that are in his or her branch of government, okay? To me, this would be comparable to the Speaker of the House having control over who are members of the House, you know? The Speaker has a lot of power over the procedures of the House, and the Speaker might try to, you know, do his or her best to win elections, but it's the voters who decide who the members are, not the Speaker of the House. To me, that's a conflict. That is centralizing way too much power in the hands of the Chief Justice. And so those are part of my concerns, and if that explains my motive for why I'm concerned about this, I hope it does anyway.
Mr. Carruthers, I'm trying to balance time here, and I've given you approximately the same amount of time as Governor Quay. We have two questions from Representative Olson will be first, and Representative Wolschweiger, and then we're going to move to the next testifier. So Representative Olson.
Mr. Chair, I'll pass for time.
All right, Representative Wolschweiger.
Chair members, I have constituents who are contacting me because they are scared. They are downright scared about partial elections. They don't for judges. Frankly, they don't like the partisanship that Mr. Carruthers that you're talking about and what we engage in. But you know, it's part of the our race. But when they think about the judges, it scares them. So, you know, I'm interested in what suggestion you have in response to more political elections. That's what the main concern is from people contacting me.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chairman, you know, that's why I brought your attention to the alternative. The point I'm making about retention elections is because these are constitutional rights, and probably a lot of us don't agree with the White decision, but this is constitutional rights. It's all based on the First Amendment, you know, freedom of speech. And my point on retention elections is it's just a different type of election. It doesn't change anything. The freedoms of speech and raising money and making commitments and filling out questionnaires, all of that stuff applies just as equally to retention elections. And in fact, there have been very famous retention elections that have been very nasty, very expensive, very partisan. You know, California, Rose Byrd being defeated. Tennessee, you know, a governor of one party attacked a Supreme Court member appointed by a governor of a different party. It was a vicious attack, and the net benefit of it was that that governor then got to replace a Supreme Court member appointed by a governor of a different party. So, you know, just because you move around the squares a little bit, you don't change the basic freedoms that the Supreme Court has declared, whether we agree with them or not. We just have to live with what the law is, and just because we wish that partisan politics and nastiness would go away, it's not going to go away just because you change the form of the election. But there are certainly things that can be done, and I personally think these are a whole host of good alternatives that can be done without changing the fundamental structure of our government.
Mr. Carruthers, thank you, and I'm going to move to the next testifier, please. Greg Belinsky. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, my name is Greg Belinsky. I'm an attorney in Minneapolis and the former president of the Minnesota Defense Lawyers Association. I'm not here on behalf of that association today, but that's my background. I was a member of the Cree Commission. I can tell you that as a lawyer practicing in Minnesota with national clients, I have always been very proud to be able to say to them when they come to Minnesota that they will be in front of an impartial judiciary. I hear stories from these clients about what happens in other states, about money that needs to be placed on judicial counters when judges expect a contribution from people who appear before them. And I'm delighted to be able to tell these folks, these clients from outside Minnesota, that that simply doesn't happen here. We've had a long history of an impartial judiciary, and I think that my time spent on the Cree Commission has taught me that what has happened in other states could simply happen here as well, that the post-white world is such that we will be experiencing direct contested elections, inevitably, more television ads, more negative campaigning, and with special interest groups exerting their influence. This isn't a statement about conservatives or liberals, because both camps play this game, and both come out with their guns blazing. It's clear to us, those of us who participated in the Citizens Commission, that retention elections in other states have been an excellent vehicle for avoiding these problems. No system's perfect, but retention elections, performance evaluation, combined with merit selection, I believe are the best combination to ensure that we maintain an impartial judiciary. Thank you for your efforts on this subject and taking this matter seriously. We appreciate it.
Any questions? Thank you, Mr. Bronski. The next I have are Judge Charles Porter and Judge Susan Miles. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for hearing from me today. I'm Judge Chuck Porter. I serve on the trial court in Minneapolis, the 4th Judicial District. I'm here today, however, as the president of the Minnesota District Judges Association. With me is our vice president, Susan Miles, who sits in Silver. The Minnesota District Judges Association has been active and interested in the issue of judicial elections for over 15 years actively. We have studied this issue on an ongoing basis as the various debates have taken place in other states and here. And in 2002,
took a firm position then in favor of the continuation of the present system and against a change to a retention election scheme in Minnesota. While we appreciate the fact that the White decision has impacted the potential nature of the judicial selection and continuation process, we have not made a change in that position since 2002. Our position remains against retention elections and in favor of the present system. I know that in recent days, some of you have been hearing from some of our members and others on the trial court about positions taken that are not consistent with that position. The fact that you've heard shows two things. The judges are just as divided as the Klee Commission was, and we are just as concerned. Nevertheless, a change as suggested in this bill does not solve the two principal problems created by the White decision, which seems to be the energy behind this change. Those problems are the fear of sitting judges and others of a late attack during a campaign precipitated, it is thought, by either partisan or political or limited issue interest groups, and often at the last minute. Changing from a contested election to a retention system doesn't eliminate that problem. In many respects, it may exacerbate it. The other issue that seems to be driving this effort is a concern that judicial elections will become increasingly more expensive. One of the things that Representative Simon said this morning is really instructive on that point. Currently, less than 10% of the judicial elections involve a contest, and by their very nature, less than 10% involve any fundraising. $350 to file, go to the polls and make sure you vote for yourself, and get enough of your friends so that you can defeat Mickey Mouse. In only a very small proportion of the elections are funds raised. If every judge that's up for election is in a contest, and that's what a retention election will be, every year, somewhere around 40% of the judiciary, every 2 years, somewhere around 40% of the judiciary will be engaged in an election with an interest at stake that is at issue and will, of necessity, raise money. With regard to performance evaluations, and Judge Miles is going to speak at length about that. She, in addition to being the Vice President, chairs our study group on that issue. Nobody is more interested in having an informed electorate than the judges. Representative Simons remarked that the judges in Hennepin County oppose having their performance publicly evaluated is just flat wrong. The Hennepin County Bar Poll was a popularity contest. It was not a performance evaluation system. We're not afraid. In fact, we welcome a performance evaluation system that is legitimate, that evaluates not our decisions, but our decision-making. I'd be happy to respond to any questions that you have, and if there aren't any, I'd like Judge Miles to
answer. Let's have those like it.
Chair, Judge Porter, actually, what some of my constituents are saying is that what they're afraid of is that with this increased political election system for judges, that it ultimately will attract a different personality of a judge. And that's what they're worried about, is that someone who kind of enjoys the partisan fight, if you will, isn't exactly the type of person they want as a judge. So that's something that you didn't bring up, but...
Judge Porter.
Representative, Mr. Chair, Representative Wolfshager,
I guess I have two things to say about that. The first is that we've had two full election cycles since the first White decision was made, was handed down. And the things which are stated as the fears simply haven't happened. You have a summary that was provided to you by our legislative counsel, Ms. Niren. The two candidates who sought political endorsement in 2006, one of them didn't even make it through the primary. So this idea that we're going to attract the wrong kind of people to the process, I mean, I have to say, in all candor, I spent a week ago Friday in a educational experience with one of our newest judges. I think his name is Tom Neville. And if he is the wrong kind of person being attracted to the judiciary, I disagree with that. You know, maybe it's possible at some time that it becomes so political and so away from what the real issues are. That certainly is a possibility. It certainly is the threat that's being bandied about. We just don't think that now is the time for this sweeping a change, which doesn't solve the problem that it says it's directed to solve.
Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Judge Porter, for your candidness today, because I have received at least one of those phone calls from your members who are not certain that the association's position is one that they agree with. I guess my question would be, seeing that you openly admit that that is something that's going on within the association, are there any recommendations that the association has about changes to Representative Simon's bill that you discussed with Representative Simon? Do you anticipate any of those recommendations coming forward soon? Where do you see the association moving on this issue as a result of this uncertainty within your organization?
Judge Port.
Representative Morgan and Mr. Chair, thank you. I don't think I'm being overly candid. I mean, you all know that there's disagreements among the judges. Fortunately for you as legislators, almost all the time, there are only two opinions that constitute the disagreement. In our case, there are three. And those three currently seem to be the opinion that the organization takes, our traditional, long-standing, and current position, that change is not appropriate now. There are, then, two other groups, one of whom believes that change is appropriate now and favors a retention-type system, as is proposed in Representative Simon's bill. And the other group believes that change is appropriate, but that it should be a change which changes to a system that solves the two problems. And at the time when our last membership discussion of this sort took place, that was the Quay Minority Report. We govern by a majority, and even more so by the majority that shows up. And there wasn't a majority for any of the three positions. There was spirited and candid and nonpartisan in any real sense debate about these three proposals, and there isn't a consensus to change our current position.
President Murray, anything?
Judge Moss.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for having us here today. As Judge Porter said, my piece is the performance evaluation piece. I will be convening the inaugural meeting of the newly constituted MBJA Performance Evaluation Committee this Friday. It's not the first time we've had a performance evaluation committee. There have been predecessors going back. There have been predecessors going back into the early 90s. And on that note, I would state that this performance evaluation issue has been studied by various committees constituted by both the Supreme Court and the trial court bench, as well as the Bar Association. And in two different reports, in, I believe, 1993 and 1996, all agreed performance evaluations were a good idea. However, They also recognized reality, and that was that a decent performance evaluation system was not likely to receive the funding that it required. And so at that point, the latest commission to study this issue in 1996 recommended that each of the districts adopt their own procedures for evaluating their judges. And that's the system that we do have in place today. There is a performance evaluation system administered at the district level whereby each judge within 2 years of running for office and winning office must send out evaluations not only to attorneys but to staff members and others that are in a position to comment on their performance. The results are evaluated, compiled at the district level, and then sent to the judge in a way that preserves the confidentiality of the respondents. There is no funding for this program, and there is no follow-up. This information is for the judge to use as he or she sees fit. Fast forward to today and what's going on in the present environment. The performance evaluation push was initiated by the American Bar Association in 1985, which adopted some guidelines for states to follow in the event that they were going to pursue a performance evaluation program. To date, we have seven states in the interim 22-23 years which have adopted a public performance evaluation system. Most recently, the concept of a public performance evaluation system was overwhelmingly rejected by a specially convened committee in the state of Florida, and their report was issued this last summer in July. They cited as their reason for rejecting the evaluation system a danger to judicial independence, and the report noted that despite good intentions, the process would be subject to hijacking by other branches of government, and that the cost of the program would exceed the relatively meager potential benefit. My point is this, that the proposed performance evaluation system, which has been modified somewhat since the bill I was studying last night and preparing to make my comments today, and it's made progress, but it either has the potential to be the backbone or the Achilles heel of this proposal. And if it's going to be the backbone, it has to be done right and it has to be funded right. And so far, and I don't mean to get bogged down in the details of what a performance evaluation system ideally should look like, but it does carry with it components which must be in place to have a fair and accurate system of evaluating performance. And these things come at a cost. And if there's any suggestion that that cost should be borne by the judicial branch out of its current budget, then that's as good as dooming a performance evaluation system to failure.
Judge Miles, can you enlighten this committee on the cuts that the judicial branch took to balance the budget in 2004? Do you recall what that was?
I'll defer to Judge Porter on that.
Judge Porter.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. The judiciary made a request for 97% funding of our current operations with two limited increases. We received essentially 93% funding and the two increases. And I don't think that it's news that the governor is asking us to consider an additional 3% take back for this.
And then Judge Porter, that the mandated fee increases that balanced the budget in 03 and 04, did those go to the judicial system or did they go to general revenue?
They went to general revenue.
All right. And is it also true that there are district courts that are closed for half a day in this state?
Our court is closed for half a day.
But I'm glad you remembered.
That isn't completely a product of the underfunding issue. It's largely, but not completely a product. We also, and actually in the end, thank the legislature for funding the conversion to a statewide new data management system. That conversion has been much more labor intensive and much more expensive than we thought it was going to be at the time when we asked for it. And that's part of the reason that we're having to close half a day just to catch up on that.
I want to underscore Judge Miles' comments here that the courts received a hit in the 2003-04 and did not get any of the new revenue from the increases in fees, which were dramatic. So, Judge Miles, proceed. I'm still trying to keep a balance here, so we've got about a couple minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And coming from a county where it has just been decided that we, too, have to close our public windows for a half a day a week and lay off potentially 10 staff, it hurts. And I'm wondering where the money is going to come to fund development of a survey tool, collection and compilation of data, bearing meeting and hearing expenses, distribution of the data to the public, and last but not least, public outreach on the purpose of these evaluations, if they're going to do anybody any good. Just to note expenditures that have been devoted to these items in other states, Arizona spent $400,000 last year to evaluate 66 judges, and that does not include the $100,000 note for printing and mailing voters' guides to the public. Utah has just, I understand, attached an $800,000 fiscal note to its budget. And it's, by the way, its advisory committee in the past has criticized the Judicial Council for not having adequate funding from their legislature, given the purposes of the program. Colorado spent approximately $400,000 in election years, and by the way, when they first started their system in 1996, their own commission reported back to the legislature that perfecting a judicial performance evaluation process, which provides the public and judicial officers with the essential information, given the limited resources, has been a tedious undertaking. As a result, the program may be viewed in some circles as being stagnant and unresponsive. And finally, a Florida judge back in 1995 wrote about the critical lack of resources and excessive caseload that are increasingly a feature of state courts and how it is unfair to embark on a performance evaluation process in that sort of an environment. So again, I want to close by saying we do have performance evaluations in Minnesota. They're not funded, and if we go down this road, we just want them to be fair and accurate and adequately funded.
Any further questions from the committee? All right. Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Justice Barry Anderson, I believe, is here today. Is that correct? Yes, there he is.
Mr. Chairman, while there's a lull in the action.
Representative House.
Thank you. I don't know if anyone else had judge elections in their district that were what I would call a bona fide election. In other words, it was a real election. The non-incumbent worked very, very hard, and the non-incumbent won the race, but it wasn't that the sitting judge or the non-incumbent spent hundreds of thousands of dollars. It was a grassroots, handshaking, information getting out there effort, and the process worked very well in my district last year, and the challenger won. So maybe we don't need to change it right away.
Thank you. Justice Anderson, welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Barry Anderson. I serve as an associate justice on the Minnesota Supreme Court. I want to note for purposes of the record that I am not the Chief Justice. I'm one of the other Andersons, identified as otherwise on the agenda this morning. I'm going to speak very briefly. I realize you have a number of other folks who are scheduled to testify, and I'm just going to talk for a couple of minutes here and allow you to get on to the rest of your agenda. I will just tell you that I begin with the observation that if I thought our present system of electing judges was likely to survive in the years ahead and in the elections ahead, I would join my classmate and friend Phil Carruthers in suggesting that no change is necessary. But because I don't think that's going to be the case, and because I think that the trend is entirely the other direction, I think it's now reasonable and necessary that we be proactive about addressing that issue. It is on that basis that I've had an interest in this topic, and as some of you know, I have direct experience in this area because I have on three occasions been endorsed by a major political party, and on each of those three occasions I have declined that endorsement because I do not believe partisan endorsements are appropriate in judicial elections, notwithstanding the right of political parties to do so under the First Amendment. Let me say that I spent a great deal of time on the commission thinking and working my way through these issues, and I was a fairly late convert to the concept of retention elections. But one of the things that made me a convert is that the combination of merit selection, gubernatorial appointment, performance review, and retention elections, as experienced by other states, has resulted in a system that, while not perfect, produces state judiciaries that have far fewer of the highly partisan, expensive, negative elections that we've heard discussions about today. Now, what do I mean by that? If you look at the data, in other words, avoiding cherry-picking specific races, and just look at the global data, what you find is that in those states that have that combination that I have suggested, even in some states that don't have performance review but have retention elections, much less money is spent in campaigning. And let's understand here that unlike some who have suggested that the problem is candidates raising money, I think the bigger problem is independent groups and others who are raising money over which we have no control. And the advantage of the retention election model is that candidates who are subject to challenge are not subject to being replaced by those special interest groups who can afford to find a candidate, fund their own candidate for that seat. And instead, you have the merit selection model to fill the vacancy. Let me say a word about the data, and then I think I'll conclude and leave this for others. You heard earlier, Governor Klee noted that in the 2006 election cycle, over $30 million was spent in partisan and nonpartisan Supreme Court races where candidates ran against each other. About $1,000 was raised in the 34 seats, $1,000 total, in the 34 seats that were subject to retention elections. And if you add in the 2005 election cycle, according to the New Politics of Judicial Elections in 2006, publication of the Brennan Center, you find that in the 2005-2006 election cycle, where there was a very expensive race in Pennsylvania, here are the totals. 378,000 in nonpartisan races, or 378,000 in partisan races, 214,000 in nonpartisan races, and $27,000 in average in those states. So even when you have years where there are problems, the retention election model works well in dealing with those issues. What this ultimately comes down to, in my view, is maintaining an impartial judiciary. And it's for those of you who participated in and were part of the informational hearing or heard about the informational hearing of a couple of weeks ago, you are aware that surveys of judges themselves say that they have concerns about being influenced by campaign financing and campaign expenditures. And the successful justice who won in Illinois in a race where $9 million was spent expressed something to the effect that how can anyone have confidence in this system? It's important to understand that we ask judges to do something very different than the important duties we ask the executive and legislative branch to do. That is, we ask them to decide cases impartially and to apply the facts to the law. And when we get into this environment, it becomes increasingly difficult for the public to have trust and confidence in the courts. If I thought we were going to be able to maintain the existing system, the kind of election in which we didn't have these kinds of issues, I probably wouldn't be here for you today. But I see states like Washington and Wisconsin, very much like Minnesota, nonpartisan states, nonpartisan judicial election states, that at one time didn't have traditions of these kinds of campaigns, and now have them. And I say that day is coming to Minnesota in the future. Well, whether it'll be 2008 or 2010 or 2012, I do not know, but it is coming. And it is on that basis that I support generally, although I'm not a member of Governor Klee's group, and I probably can find some specific things in this bill that I don't agree with, and perhaps the time we'll have time someday to talk about maybe a point or two here and there. But in general, I am supportive of the concept of merit selection of judges, gubernatorial appointment, performance evaluation, and retention elections. And I think the time has come to have that conversation. Thank you.
Representative Kalin, you're on my list.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Justice Anderson, first I wanted to thank you personally for the time that you took out of your schedule with Justice Page when I was entertaining some sixth graders on the steps below the chambers. I think it was 8 or 9 weeks ago. I still hear the from parents of the students that they went home and told how remarkable your short address on liberties and impartial judiciary, the importance of the impartial judiciary on our liberties in this country and in this state. And so I want to personally thank you for taking that time. I do have serious reservations about the retention election provisions. I've spoken with Representative Simon about it personally. I've also spoken with others. I'll be voting to move the bill along to the judiciary, to Civil Justice and Public Safety Policy Committee that I sit on as well for further discussion. But I'm wondering if you might be able to address the retention portion a little more deeply for a moment.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Galen, thank you for the opportunity to do just that. Let me talk a little bit about the data. The data indicates that if you look at retention elections over a long period of time, basically over a 20-year plus trend, there are the evidence is that retention elections involve races where the judge is rarely defeated. The accusation has been made, we've heard it several times now in the course of these proceedings, that we have situations where judges are subject to drive-by attacks. I think that's a possibility, and I suspect it has occurred. I want the committee to understand, though, that there are 30,000 judges in the United States, 80% of which are subject to election in one form or another. And when I started looking at the data to see if this occurs, what I came up with were a handful, 3, 4, 5, 6 examples of where the so-called drive-by challenges occurred, where a judge was subject to what might be arguably an unfair attack and was then defeated. And I think you could argue the merits of that handful and say this one doesn't apply, that one doesn't apply, but the point is globally, it's a relatively small number. And understand that my concern is not that any individual judge or justice loses his or her job. That's really of relatively modest significance. Well, it's of great significance to me, personally. But collectively, the question is my replacement a qualified, impartial jurist? And the advantage of the merit selection model is it's designed to deal with that issue. Now, is it perfect? No. But does it work well in many of these states, most of these states? Perhaps all of these states, I think it does. There's one peer-reviewed study, which I'd be happy to provide to the committee, that shows that out of approximately 6,000 retention elections over a 20-plus year span, we're talking about less than 60 defeats. That includes retention elections in district courts and in state courts, in state supreme courts. And of course you have much higher defeat rates partisan and nonpartisan races. So I think the accusation that somehow retention elections will destabilize the system is not accurate. In fact, I would argue that the retention election model comes closest to retaining what Minnesota now has. And I would argue that what we have now effectively is a form of retention election in actual practice, and that this will accomplish a replacement of that. The importance here is that you keep the public in the loop. The public still has the opportunity if it desires to fire a judge, but ultimately the hope is that you don't have to worry about special interests raising large sums of money and replacing a judge with someone more suitable to their liking.
Chris Symbols.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Justice Anderson, I'm finding a common thread here in all the testifiers, and I'd like to first ask if you can confirm for the committee for us whether or not any, since the White decision, whether or not there has been any judges elected with a partisan endorsement.
Justice Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Olson, Minnesota, the answer is no.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just going to highlight this common thread that I'm seeing. Mr. Belinsky, he began his comments highlighting how he's very proud of our impartial courts. Judge Porter talked about 2 years since the White decision, and the problems have not occurred.
in your comments, I heard you identify your basis for being here as it's going to be a problem. With this, I see a parallel common thread, in that partisan elections will cause us to lose good judges. There's a presumption that a partisan election is going to cause us to lose good judges, and that more money means a bad election. There's a presumption there. But neither one of those I see as actual truth, that if there's a partisan label, it's definitely going to be a bad judge, regardless of the party label, and that more money means a bad election. All of that combined leaves me on this question, why? If we really don't yet have problems from the white decision, and nobody's yet been elected with a partisan label, not showing any merit to even having it, and I don't like it in the judiciary myself. I concur with you on that point, and I really, really do. But I'm struggling with this issue. So far, I see a common thread here that still leaves me on this page. Why? Why now, and why the change? It's not being answered yet.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Olson, your challenge is a good one, and I think it is a respectable intellectual argument and respectable intellectual position to take, to say we shouldn't do anything. We should wait for a problem to develop, and that's a not unreasonable position to take, and it's a position that I personally believed in until 2-3 years ago when I started looking more seriously at this question. What convinced me that we needed to have this conversation now is that when you look at other states that have gone down the road of highly partisan, competitive, expensive elections, is that they've had great difficulty getting people to the table to talk about possible solutions to this problem. Because what happens is people get invested in the system that they have. And you have all of the suspicions and difficulties associated with trying to overcome that. And so it's on that basis that I say that the time is now to have this conversation, not when the problem occurs. So your point is not without merit. The question is, how confident are you if we go down that road, are we going to be able to deal with the problem at that time? I'm not very confident. Let me say a word about the question about bad judges. I'm glad you asked that question, because I don't think the argument is a judge who has a partisan background or has some partisan experience is somehow not a good judge. I certainly don't think that's true of former Senator Neville. And for those of you who are members of the committee, and certainly Representative Olson would know this, I spent some time as general counsel to a major political party, and I'd hate to see that was a disqualifying factor in my service in the judiciary. But the problem becomes when you link highly competitive partisan elections and spending, you create this perception issue with the public. And that becomes a very significant hurdle to overcome when you're asking judges to decide questions impartially, as opposed to being elected on platforms to enact specific policies. So I think the question is more trust and confidence in the court rather than any specific judge elected in a highly partisan election as being not qualified or not competent to serve.
Right. I hope that's responsible. Please be brief. We're trying to balance time here, and we have about 6 minutes left for this hearing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very brief comment or question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will. Thank you, Justice Anderson, for that response. I believe the people are going to continue to react to partisan endorsements for judges. I think they're ahead of us on this, and I don't think we have a problem, though I do believe we need to change it and bring accountability to the judiciary through other means, which is how we ended up with partisan elections in the first place.
Representative Winkler.
I concur with what you're saying.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Justice Anderson, the only thing I would add to what you said is that it is, in fact, too late. Once you have this specter of partisan, highly politicized, expensive judicial elections, because the thing that is very hardest for government to regain is confidence and trust in the public and the integrity of the judiciary. And I think that the public's confidence in the judiciary's independence is the most important factor that we have for being a society governed by the rule of law. If you believe that everything is up for grabs, there is no rule of law to defend.
Representative Kahn.
Justice Anderson. I'd just like to throw my problem, and I'm a co-author of the bill, so I obviously support the bill, but my problem with the judiciary is the persistent problems of two deficiencies, and that is the concept of innumeracy and scientific illiteracy. And is there any way that we can move to help that in the system? Is there anything in merit selection or judicial training or anything else that could move us in that track?
Justice Sanderson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn, all I can tell you is that my political science and history degree does not qualify me to answer that question. your point is well taken, however. We'll have further conversation about that.
Good. Good answer. We have 5 minutes left. I'm going to bring Representative Simon back down. Members, I have tried to balance this pro-con, and I have also tried to balance time. I regret that we have a number of people who are on the list, but frankly, I have over 300 bills that this committee has and at least a dozen constitutional amendments. So we will let the author of the bill have the final word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, I want to thank you and the committee for the time you've spent. Mr. Chair, you in particular. I know that you're in much demand to a lot of time, and you've been very generous, and the committee has as well. As you can see here, everyone who's testified really basically wants the same thing. Whether it's the opponents of this bill or the proponents, we all want to maintain an independent judiciary, and everyone here is a person of goodwill, and everyone here is having something to debate. I just want to respond to a few of the points about this bill. One is just overall, you know, you're not going to find a perfect solution. And as I've come to understand in my brief career here, it's far easier to kill something than to pass something. All you have to do is go around and pass and plant a seed of doubt and talk about the parade of horribles and talk about what could happen. And we're all naturally cautious and conservative by nature, small c. And I think that's often a compelling argument. We don't want to do something that we'll later regret. And Speaker Carruthers is right. This is the Constitution we're talking about. So we ought not to act hastily. But I can tell you, as you've seen today, from the seriousness with which all of us are treating this issue, this is anything but a hasty decision. We're talking about doing what's best for Minnesota, not what's perfect for Minnesota. And in my judgment, and the judgment of many others with a lot more experience than I, who have endorsed this proposal, be they sitting judges, former vice presidents, governors, and others, this is the best solution to the problem before us. And it is a problem. I go back to what I talked about at the beginning, and I think we're all concerned about this, the idea of campaigning on outcomes, which every one of us freely and happily and proudly do, but judges or potential judges should not do. How would you like to be the litigant how would you like to be a labor union official sitting before the judge who says he's going to beat up on the union bosses? Or how would you like to be someone from the business community before a judge who said he's going to, you know, crush big business and greedy malefactors of wealth? You wouldn't like that, and that's the system I fear that we're heading towards. We're not exceptional. We're not unique. It's happened in Wisconsin. It's happened in Washington, and it's only a matter of time before it comes here. So the question is, what's the best way, not the perfect way, what's the best way that we can combat the problem? And I would say we sort of have an argument over here over which election is more Soviet, I guess, or more dictatorial, and I think reasonable minds can disagree. Do we want the current system where almost, for practically speaking, there aren't real elections. Very few judges have any sort of competition. Or do we want a situation where each and every time the judge will at least potentially or possibly lose his or her job? There are advantages and disadvantages to each, and I would hope that we don't make a decision based on the fact that there's a disadvantage. I would hope that with any bill, we make a decision on weighing the advantages and the disadvantages. And at least where I come down, and I hope you will too, members, is that balancing all the advantages and disadvantages, should we do nothing and wait for the problem to come? Should we have the sort of September 10th mindset? Or should we see the problem that's coming towards us and make the necessary modifications? Not a perfect proposal. We can't and we shouldn't, under the First Amendment, get rid of all politicization. People can and should be able to say whatever they want. The question is which system will make less likely, not eliminate, but make less likely the possibility that we'll have the full-throated, expensive, ideologically driven campaigns that so many other states have endured. And I've come to the conclusion that this is that proposal. So with that, Mr. Chair, I ask respectfully as a member of this committee for my fellow committee members to vote yes on this because it's the best possible solution.
I then renew my motion that House File 3023, as amended, be recommended to pass and be sent to the Public Safety and Civil Justice Committee. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay?
No.
Motion prevails. Bill is passed. Members not yet. Representative Morgan. Mr. Chair? Representative Morgan.
Chair, I'd like to move the minutes of Wednesday, February 20th.
Representative Morgan moves the minutes of February 20th. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. With that, meeting is adjourned.